Hi, this is Mark Talbot. I post a Zolt in a 20-foot radius.
Hi, this is Derek Myers. I post as Amaron at dungeonsmaster.com, and welcome to our podcast, Recounting Encounters.
A show where we talk about what happened at D&D Encounters this week. Everybody. Welcome to D&D Encounters, Season 12, Against the Cult of Chaos. This week, we discuss Session 6 with Derek and Craig again. How are you guys doing tonight?
Pretty good. Doing good,
Excellent.
thanks.
Excellent. I didn't get to play this week because I was in Toronto last week, so my group didn't get together, and unfortunately, I'd forgotten to leave an adventure with one of the ba with my backup DM. So I would say take it away, either Derek or Craig, and let's see what happened at your tables this week.
Yeah, I'll start. The one encounter that I played, Craig ran, so he'll talk about that in a minute, and I'll pipe in with my thoughts from the player's point of view. But for the DM's point of view, I ran the Reptile God encounter, which was the third leg of the Golden Green Inn storyline. This one, I had actually played this one at Craig's table, geez, week three, I think, like when we were still
Yeah,
level one, and
that's
we
right.
got crushed. It was a really tough fight then. So knowing that, I've been trying to keep in mind how I might change it, or even subtle changes, just to make sure that the players don't feel overwhelmed. It was a pretty straightforward encounter. We actually, at the end of last week's encounter, which was the Temple of the Lawbringer, you have an opportunity to basically interrogate any of the prisoners and try and gather information. We didn't do any of that last week. We started the session with that this week, and it worked out really well because we had a new player show up. And so I just said she was one of the people in the cells, and they're like, "Who are you?" And she's like, "I'm an adventurer." And they're like, "All right, welcome aboard." And she was playing one of the Drow pregens, and we have two of the other players at the table are playing Drow as well. So we're just like, "Okay, why don't we say you guys all knew each other?" And you're like, "Oh, that's where you disappeared to." And so that was an easy way to introduce her to the party. So yeah, the party did a little bit of role play. They did some searching. They did a little bit of questioning of Priestess Devi, and of course she feigned that she had been under the control of what of this mind control, and they bought it hook, line, and sinker. They totally believed her, and then they decided to go up to the upper level to check on Sir Moonbrook. And they left the priestess alone by herself. And when they came back, she was gone. They're like, "Oh my God, what happened to her?" I'm like, "Oh, she was a traitor. She took off." They were pretty upset that they didn't see through that. So that sort of bummed them out a little bit. But then they went through anyway. They went on through the altar to the teleport altar. They ended up in the little boat. I actually remember to bring my boat tile this week. So that was a nice little add-on.
The
And then
tile,
they.
what tile?
Now, from one of the DM rewards from way back when, from LFR days, was like a dungeon tile sheet, and it had boats on it,
Oh,
and so
nice.
it came with two little rowboats, and they used the same tiles in one of the layer assaults, and so I had a couple of little rowboats, so I brought one with me, and everyone's like, "Oh my God, that's so cool! Does it come with the rowboat?" And I'm like, "No, that's mine." So like they were more excited about that than anything else. Yeah, so anyway, they took the boat out, and one of the characters had acquired the boots of water walking at the moat house previously, so that certainly helped.
Did they push the boat? Did they do like kind of like the motor in the back and walking on the water
Nice.
and pushing the boat?
No, no, no. I didn't have the description of the boots with me. I forgot to look it up, so I just basically I ruled it. I couldn't remember the exact specifics, so I just said to the guy, "I go, here's the deal. If you take a move action on your turn to actually move at least one square, you stay on the surface of the water. If you do not take a move action to move at least one square, you sink beneath the water. And the only way you can use the boots again is if you get out of the water and walk on top again. You can't just elevate yourself to the top from nothing." And he's like, "Okay, that's fair." So basically, it forced him to keep moving if he wanted to stay on the water. So we figured that was a fair trade. But yeah, no, it was most of our party is all melee. We've got three slayers and a barbarian, so they had to get right in there to fight the monster. And they basically managed to get the boat right up to the shore, and then they all jumped over the NPCs, the prisoners. So the difficult terrain didn't really bother them. And then the Naga kept pushing them and pushing them, but I managed to finally dominate the barbarian. This was great. So I managed to dominate the barbarian. And he had the ongoing poison from a previous attack, so he was already bloodied. And then I dominated him. And at the start of his next turn, the ongoing poison knocked him unconscious. I was like, oh, man, that sucks. Unfortunately for the party, because he never got to act and he was still dominated because it's a save ends effect, the healer, we only have one healer in the party. He only had one healing power. He used it to revive the dominated character so that on his next turn, he could then attack one of his neighbors. So the player even said that. He goes, well, I know he's dominated because you just told him he's dominated. But he's like, my player would have no idea he's dominated because he never acted out of character yet. I'm like, that's correct. You play it as you see fit. And the player sort of hummed and hawed and went, no, my character wouldn't know that. So I was very pleased that this player was able to separate player knowledge from character knowledge and still revived his ally, knowing full well that it was going to cost the ally on the opposite side of him probably a healing surge worth of damage. But no, it was a fun encounter. The undead wraith, man, probably attacked 6 or 7 rounds in a row, didn't hit at all. I'd missed every single attack. It was awful. But likewise, the party spent minimal time trying to attack it because they didn't really perceive it as a big threat. So by the end of the fight, the wraith was the only thing left standing. It had not taken any damage at all. So I basically at that point just turned it into a minion. And I'm like, first character to hit it, it dies. And it happened to be a character using a radiant power. So I'm like, oh, is that a radiant keyword? Oh, that ultimately destroys it. They're like, oh, we're so lucky. So it's like, you know, just by that point, they had spent a lot of resources. They were really because we had we're so striker heavy. We had 4 strikers. I pumped up the Naga's hit points to 200. I think it's supposed to be about 125 in the first round. And I decided this at the beginning of the combat before anyone had acted. In the first round, they did 125 points of damage before the Naga even got to act.
Holy crap!
The barbarian did like 65 points of damage on his hit, and it wasn't even a critical attack. He just rolled amazing. Jeez. He used his daily power. He threw on his racial power. Oh yeah, it was disgusting. And then he used an action point and he hit again. It was gross how much their output. And I mean, they played the characters exactly like they're supposed to, right? A striker's supposed to do crazy damage. All of them did crazy damage in their first round. They all used their action point in the first round. You couldn't have telegraphed it better. But then, you know, because they expended everything in the first round, it took them like another 7 or 8 rounds before they finally got the creature down. But no, it was fun. It was interesting. Canidus Yide was there as an NPC. So she was able to throw them some heals, which they badly needed. Had she not been there to revive a couple of unconscious characters, it could have easily been a TPK. But no, in the end, it was all good. They acquired the crown. And we ran out of time. We were at the 2-hour point at that point. So unfortunately, I didn't have a chance to do the skill challenge part. I just sort of talked them through it and said, you know, I hate to do it this way, but this is sort of the second half of this challenge. Because I knew that the party was going to get an extended rest at the end, because I knew the party was going to level up at the end, I wasn't overly concerned if they lost healing surges or had any sort of negative effects in that regard. I mean, it's possible that they could have lost some of the NPCs along the way if they had flubbed the rolls, but in the interest of time, I wasn't going to sweat it too much. So next week, they have the second half of the Moat House is their final final encounter before they face the finale. So that was my week.
That sounds really good. It's a lot different than how we ran ours, but yeah, striker mm-hmm. heavy party.
Well, we've talked about this before. Mm-hmm. There have been some weeks like the Caves of Chaos was exceptionally tough. Yeah, they have strikers, and yeah, the strikers do crazy damage, but they can only attack one guy at a time. Yeah. So when you're overrun by minions, doing 50 damage doesn't matter if the minion only needs 1 point to die. So some better balance in the party makeup would have made other encounters a lot easier. Their lack of a solid leader, the lack of a controller has really made some encounters exceptionally challenging. This was one of the ones where if you're a striker heavy party, it was actually in your favor. But this is the first one in a long time where they've just basically walked all over it.
Hmm. Nice. So you played at Harry T, right, Derek?
Yeah, I ran Silver Snail, and I played it at Harry T, and I played at Craig's table. We actually had, and Craig can talk about this in a little more detail, we've been running 2 tables at Harry T North, and unfortunately this week, 3 or 4 of the players that play at the other table, they all carpool in together, and their driver was ill. So unfortunately, we didn't have enough to run 2 tables, so we had to combine. I think it was 2 of the players from the other table joined our group. Which is fine, but I can't remember. Craig, had they already done this encounter?
No, they're going to be doing it this next week.
Yeah, so I mean, this is going to be the first time at that store where this has been sort of a complication or an issue. But
yeah,
I mean, we'll sort of see how it plays out. You never know. Next week we may end up only running one table again. Who knows?
Yeah, it's true.
So yeah, Greg, tell us all about
people. Oh yeah, well first let me preface my story by saying that. The particular day that we're running this adventure, it was extremely busy for me at work, and I did not get a good night's sleep the night before, and I had some terrible troubles from, I assume it was from the weather getting in. The subway shut down a couple of times on my freaking way in, so they kept kicking us off the trains. It was just a long and a grueling ride in, but I made it, but unfortunately I had to forego dinner, so... Already this encounter for me, I felt like it was off to a bad start because I was starving, tired, and my mind was kind of mush from work. However, that being said, we did get into it. We did the second half of the Moat House, and basically we picked up, I guess, where it was last left off, and what the heck did we do the previous week? Oh, yes, that's right, the first Moat House. So the players come back to town. With I believe her name's Edna, the halfling, lead of the bandits, and one of the dwarves in tow, bringing some of the goods that they had reacquired from the bandit hideout. They brought her into the constable to have her locked up, and I know at one point they tried to perhaps get some horses as well.
Yeah, one of the guys, because we decided we were going to go back to the second level of the boat house to investigate. We wanted to do it quickly. And one of the guys was convinced we needed horses, so that became a big part of the role playing.
Trying to get horses, but anyway, I mean, even before you did any of that, you guys decided to check out the Rainin and Grimag, I believe their names are, at the trading post. But it was after hours, and when the player party scouted it out, they found that the warehouse had a light on in the back of the warehouse, but the main building was all dark. So two of the stealthier players, Derek being one of them, had decided to take it upon themselves to scout ahead and check out the dark building. They found it was completely empty. They did a little bit of searching through the stuff, found a secret room that had a whole bunch of just sloppy notes and like crates of cloaks and things like that. So they brought those all out and were able to discover that the passphrase was included in the notes, amongst some other things, as well as they got everyone their cloaks for getting in. So they didn't even have to have an encounter with Rain and Grimegg.
Stealth for the win.
Yeah, exactly.
And our dice were on fire. Between our stealth checks, our perception checks, our thievery checks.
They were just 30 points.
Was, yeah. I rolled six checks. I don't think I rolled less than 16 on the D20 ever. And all of those skills, I'm rolling on like 7 or 8 or more. Like, yeah, it was disgusting. The numbers were so insanely high.
They were so high. Most of the time, I didn't even have to consult any of the DCs to make sure that I had it right. Because I was like, oh, there's no way they screw that up.
That sounds like my skill challenge from a couple weeks back.
Yeah, but, exactly.
But I did have it so Raiden and Grimag were doing something... had you decided to go into the warehouse, they would have walked in on something interesting, but they were able to stealth it out and get what they needed without having to encounter that.
Very cool.
But they went back, tried to talk their way into getting horses, and they weren't able to. And then there's a little bit of a conversation, well, should we go to one of the outlying farms and steal some horses?
This was an interesting conversation to have in front of the constable.
Yeah, exactly. Right in the constable's office. And then eventually, you know, I had to say, like, listen, if you guys really wanted to go and steal horses, you would spend so much time preparing a plan and, you know, trying to steal a horse, not get caught. And, like, first of all, finding a farm where they're, you know, that would be close by, that you probably would take the same amount of time if you just hoofed it from here right now. So the decision was made. May as well walk, because the guys already knew the way. And what they had discerned from finding the password was that it appeared that every day the password was different. The passphrase, I should say. So a bunch of the words had been crossed out, and they had a date stamp next to each one of them. And today's, and this is like in the middle of the night too. So the day's one, of course, being, I believe it's Annihilation, being the passphrase. They decided they didn't really have a lot of time to spare. So They went there. They, you know, approached in their appropriate attire. Now, if anyone has already played it, then it's an interesting encounter where you come in and can kind of dupe the cultists if you have the robes. So that's exactly what they're doing. They passed a couple of the checkpoints. I mean, mind you, there was a... Was there a dwarf in the party? Or halfling?
Right? Yeah. We all the characters were weird races. We had a dragonborn. We had a gith. We had a drow. A goliath. A dwarf. And then I'm playing a shifter, which is human-ish, but has those sort of, you know, wolfish qualities.
Right.
And so we're like... Everyone we've found so far has been human. Like, this is going to be a lot of work.
So, yeah, and on the way in, I increased the DCs for any of the diplomacy or the bluff checks.
Because they weren't human?
Yeah, they're a bunch of weird sizes. Until someone mentioned it was either Raynan or Grimegg. And then once one of those names got dropped, I made it sort of go back to normal. Because, like, oh, okay, they brought us in some weirdos, was kind of the thought process.
Nice.
Now, when they got to the door, when they get to Lareth's quarters, Lareth invited them in to be part of the ritual. It was at this point, Derek, because it just kind of went over my head, I didn't realize, but Derek had written me a note to indicate that one of the players was, in fact, currently wearing the death circlet from the caves of the reptile god. Yeah. So, Garrett,
not only that, but the player for every encounter so far has been going on and on about how he's wearing it and he wants to use it. Like, he's been basically prancing around, like, look at my pretty hat. So I thought there's no way he would be taking this off or making any effort to hide it. And I think that was in keeping with the character. That's why I just said, create a note. I'm like, so-and-so is still wearing the crown.
Right. And so I had Lareth brought them in, and he continued with it anyway, but he recognized that they had, you know, the circlet. And at this point, Gareth, who had made a daring escape from the previous session, was already here and had already filled them in on what had happened. So Lareth was already in the know. And in fact, Gareth was actually in the room with Lareth already, probably in the middle of our talking about what's been going on thus far. So, and I believe the player that had the death circlet decided he was going to do an insight check before they could get the ritual going. And he rolled really good, of course, and immediately realized that Gareth's eyes were plastered on the circlet. And of course, immediately he realized that this is Gareth. This is the guy that's, evaded us on two separate occasions. He was there when we slayed the reptile god. He was there, you know, when we stormed the Temple of the Lawbringer, and now here he is staring at the circlet. So clearly the jig is up. And I had the Lareth at this point had decided to, he thought it was a good idea to have the guards come in and be a part of the celebration. Of course, he was going to try and ambush them, but everyone realized the jig was up, so combat broke out.
Yeah, and this was another one of those encounters where we had tight quarters. I mean, in this case, it was because of the actions that we deliberately chose to do.
Yeah.
Unlike the one with the cellar, where it's a small map. There's really no way around it. But one of the things that I would strongly encourage DMs and players who haven't yet run this encounter is, if you do get the party trapped in the room when the combat starts, encourage the players to take actions to get out of the room. And if it means they're going to risk an opportunity attack, so be it. I know with my character, I waited until the defender had locked down and marked at least one of the major bad guys. And then I'm like, okay, that's it. I'm running past. And I risked, I think it was two opportunity attacks, and they both missed. I got lucky. But as soon as I pulled out of that room, it was a different battle, because now they weren't just sitting in the hallway taking pot shots at us. They had to fight on two fronts. And a couple of the other players followed my example. I mean, a few of them did take some hits coming through, but it was awful otherwise. Yeah.
I mean, it started off, and I believe everyone focused on Gareth initially. Gareth was the first one to drop after the first round, and then Lareth got a huge focus after that. So Lareth immediately dropped down in his hit points. So he lost a lot of effectiveness, and because they were in such cramped quarters, his fear effect thing that the power that he has that forces everyone to move away from him wasn't working out so well. I was trying to arrange it so that we would stagger the enemies in the room, and then he could use the fear effect again when he becomes bloodied and make them zigzag through all the enemies, and everyone would get all these opportunity attacks, because it wasn't a slide, push, or pull. It was a they were running because of fear.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good plan. I didn't know that's what you were trying to do.
I was trying.
I haven't run it yet as a DM. I'm running it next week, but that's a good plan. I'm going to keep that in mind.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to do, but I just wasn't able to get it in time. And just as I was starting to get it really set up, I was getting all the goons all set up outside. They got dropped. Or Lareth got dropped. So that was that for that. So that was a good thing you guys focused on Lareth right away. But yeah, I mean, it was kind of a. Everyone was kind of barred in at the beginning. They dropped. Once they got a couple of the guards down, they got Lareth and Gareth out. Then it was just a matter of taking out some of the minions that were outside. Now, the minions don't have ranged attacks, so they really didn't do a whole lot because it was such a small quarters. I couldn't cram all of them in, so I had them sort of arranging outside the room. So if they could get any forced movement out there, they would get a whole bunch of opportunity attacks. But like I said, that didn't happen.
Yeah, I didn't realize those guys didn't have ranged attacks, but I think that depending on how quickly things start to turn when I run it next week, I may say that half of them have, say, daggers. Or, you know,
not
at least with
it.
A dagger, it's like it's a one-time thing. They throw it, hit or miss, that's it, as opposed to, say, like a crossbow that potentially they could use again and again.
Yeah. And, I mean, the guards were pretty good, too. But, I mean, we had a couple of dailies expended, I believe, because this was the last one before an extended rest. So people were dropping their dailies. I mean, there's a lot of healing going on. So I thought you guys didn't struggle too bad with it. You were certainly smart in getting Lareth out of the picture pretty quick.
Yeah. One of the things that I had said during the encounter was that when we went in, half of the minions were asleep. And then once things started going wrong, it was, oh, well, on their turn, they get up and they join the combat. And I just sort of said off of them, like, hey, have you ever noticed how evil cultists in D&D always sleep in their armor? And so I posted it to Twitter. And like 15 minutes later, I got a response from Sean Merwin, who is one of the authors of the adventure. And he replied back, it's good for posture and it makes you all cranky to help with the evil doing.
And he was right.
Yes, yes.
Goodness.
But yeah, I mean, they were able to end up taking him out, and I believe they just knocked Lareth out.
Yes, I think, I can't remember, I think we're going to interrogate him at the start of the next week, I don't
remember. Yeah, because we were running kind of late at that point, because some of the role-playing at the beginning went a little longer than normal, because of the horses.
You know, what I find that funny about the horses thing, because my party did the exact same thing. They went, when we went, remember they were trying to look for Canonus Yade?
Yeah.
Yes.
Right? What'd they do? They went and bought horses. They spent 2 days going out in horses, and they said, okay, well, we come back to town and we sell them. All right? You get, like, 2 gold back. And they're like, what? We spent 30 gold. I said, well, they're used horses.
It's like when you buy a car. You don't sell it back for the same price you bought it.
Hey, as soon as it walks off the lot, it depreciates.
Yeah. Go around and kick the tires. It doesn't have tires. Oh, well, then we're going to take some bucks off for that, too.
Yeah. Start flinging road apples at people.
Indeed. But yeah, I mean, by the end of that encounter, I felt like it didn't go very well, the encounter, just from my end. But I think, I don't know if it was more just because I was exhausted from work that day and such a rough way getting in, and I was freaking starving by the end of it. So I'm not sure on your end how it felt as a player, Derek, but I felt running it that it mustn't have been as exciting as previous ones, just because I remember I was just not feeling it.
No, I had a good time. I think the role playing at the beginning sort of helped everybody. I mean, obviously, a couple of the characters, because my guy was one of the characters who was the stealthy, thievy, sneaky kind, we finally had a chance to actually put some of those skills to use. So I think myself and the other player who had those two characters do that thing sort of felt, all right, I got a chance to be the hero for one. Like, you know, yeah. I'm a firm believer that at least every week somebody should get to be the star of the show at least once a week. And so I think for me, this was one of the weeks where I got to be one of the stars of the show more so than I've been in the past. And then as far as the combat went, I mean, it was a pretty straightforward combat once we got in. So, no, I mean, you go with it. And
yeah, I guess it's just more.
I don't know if you made any changes to the numbers or the monsters, because we had a party of six, right?
I added an extra guard.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, there's only supposed to be two, but I put in three.
Which I think was a good balance, you know, given that the party, like, for the most part, I think three or four of the players are fairly experienced. So
yeah,
could certainly handle a little bit of a challenge.
Yeah, oh, and also Gareth. But, I mean, Gareth wasn't exactly Mr. Tough Guy to begin with.
Yeah.
But no, I guess it was just more because I was just so hungry and tired, and my brain was a little bit mushy. But the one that I actually played at tonight, which was the same kind of that Derek ran tonight. I won't bother reiterating because it pretty much happened as it's written. But something interesting that our DM did tonight is we have a drow player. And during the combat with the Spirit Naga, the drow player got dominated just for one round. He hit my character, knocking me out, unfortunately. But he came back too, and he sort of chalked it up in his role-playing way to say that, oh, you know, it's, I just suddenly had a taste of my dark past being in this underground, must have brought it out of me. Knowing that he got controlled by the Dark Naga, but he kind of played it up that he also kind of enjoyed doing something a little more chaotic or a little more dark. So afterwards, when we got to the skill challenge and everything was crumbling, on one of his skill challenge turns, he completely flubbed it, and the collapse killed a couple people. Now, he had taken the death circlet at this time, and he said, okay, so I failed it, but can it be that maybe I let the guy die so I could absorb the soul? Because I figured this guy was weak anyway. He wasn't going to be able to make it through. And so he's like, yeah, you know, that's absolutely right. So we all got to do insight checks to see if we noticed him doing something a little sneaky. So I don't know. I thought that was, it added a little more flavor and a little more fun to the skill challenge, to, you know, having just like, oh, you failed and, you know, you lost one of the villagers, changing it to make it more of like, well, you know, he was dominated earlier, but it sort of like rekindled a feeling that he had from, you know, way back in the day when he was a little darker natured.
Yeah, that's neat. I like that both your player came up with that idea and that the DM was willing to say yes and go with it. You know.
Yeah, he completely rolled with it, and it was something where we're like, hey, why is one of those gems lit up? You know, but it was good. It was. I really liked how that happened. So, just like the kind of like fun things that you can do, especially with a skill challenge where it's extremely open ended, and those can really run the risk of just being. Roll the dice. Did you hit the number? No. Okay, you fail one. All right, roll the dice again. Did you hit the number? Okay, no. You advance one, you know?
Yeah.
Where it can basically feel like that.
Dark Drow, evil party.
Yeah. It was sort of like a flashback to the previous, what it was, the Council of Spiders season? Yeah. But so anyway, I thought it was pretty cool. I thought I'd mention it.
Now, do you have any kind of tips regarding, because I'm going to be doing the Golden Grain Inn next week. They're doing it reverse. They're doing all that kind of stuff. So they're going to be doing the gambling last. They're probably going to kill the bullywugs and then make their way upstairs and then do the games and then maybe start a bar brawl or something.
Very nice. Very nice. So I don't know. Tips. I mean,
yeah. Sorry. I'm just thinking. So has your group already done the reptile god then?
Yeah, remember we did it all in reverse. We did the Reptile God, then we did Temple of the Lawbringer, and now they're going to find that secret passage, and then it's going to, you know, because that metal door's there.
So I guess what you need to try and figure out from the DM's point of view is the characters in the Golden Grain Inn that were previously enthralled by the Spirit Naga, are they still under the effects, or are they starting to come to? And... You know, because I mean, if you play it in the other order, I know that both Craig and I at our tables have basically said, oh, once you kill the Spirit Nag, all the people that were under its influence now are back in their right mind.
You know what? I didn't think about that.
But if you say that's what's happened, then that encounter is not going to work because half the people there are basically supposed to be under the control. What you may want to do is say that Wendell has, is such a charismatic leader that he sees this as an opportunity, and he's been able to keep them sort of under his spell, even though they're not magically hypnotized. He's been able to enthrall them with promises of wealth and, or, you know, power or whatever else, or he's got them terrified. Maybe he's intimidated them. He's like, I have inherited the power of whatever. And you're going to, like, you know, he's bluffed his ass off. Between bluff and intimidate checks, everyone's now convinced that if they don't continue doing what they've been doing, it's going to be bad for them. And then, you know, maybe you get the players to make insight checks about, you know, these people sort of seem to be not having as much fun as they're pretending to be having. Something's going on here. So,
or Wendell could have hired a bunch of thugs too to replace the ones in the tavern.
No,
or
yeah, but
kill
I
them
guess...
or find a stack of bodies down in the basement.
No, yeah, I'm sorry. Are you talking about Wendell or Bertram?
Bertram.
Oh, sorry. Who did I say?
Wendell's the halfling trader.
Yeah, no,
the halfling went Wolverine on the bar.
Yeah, no. I mean, I meant Bertram, the guy who's running the Golden Green. In my mistake, I made that name change at my table a few times, and it's thoroughly confused my group. I guess, Mark, really the challenge I think you're facing, depending on how quickly things have happened, is what are all the townsfolk that had been under the spell? What are they doing now? Are they embarrassed so they don't want to say anything so nobody's compared notes? Or are they like screaming from the rooftops, I was not in my right mind, and everyone's like, oh, neither was I. Something must be up. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, like I don't know how important that'll be to the story you're running it with your group, but it could certainly make for an interesting challenge. Like maybe, like you said, you have a big bar brawl where Wendell's brought – or no, I said it again, right? Where Bertram has hired a bunch of thugs to be in the bar, and then your characters could get into a big bar fight, and then you could have the locals come and show up to their rescue if they're getting overwhelmed, and suddenly it's a two-sided mob attack instead of just the party against this big mob of bandits.
Kind of – oh, yeah, that'd be kind of like a siege. That'd be kind of neat to run a battle of that magnitude.
You could do it like they did a few seasons – well, geez, many seasons back with D&D Encounters where every player got a minion to work as well. Oh, so it's like on your turn, yeah, you get your guy and a minion, and then you just have all the guys in the bar be minions. You just have tons of them, and you say, like, these are all the bandits. They went back to the moat house. They realized the moat house had been overrun, and they came to town, and Bertram took them in, and they've been staying upstairs in the inn all this time hiding out. And now that your guys are coming back, he sees this as an opportunity. So he's got them acting like townspeople. And then you can have the townspeople show up. And it's like, okay, now you got this giant melee. Of course, then you need to provide a map of the upstairs. So you'd probably have to pull one of the maps from a previous season of Encounters, which you wouldn't normally bring with you. But if you know that's what you want to do, it's something you can set up.
You know what? That's a fantastic idea.
It sounds like you could do a lot of fun things with this one. With that no longer being the case with the reptile god, right? So It's kind of like the door's open for you.
That's pretty cool. I find it, and once again, this is one of the pros of the adventure, right? I did everything backwards, and all because of Craig, right? I did everything backwards because of Craig, because he gave me that idea of knocking people out and just floating them on the raft. But doing it backwards has had its advantages. Like, it's been kind of weird. And, you know, a bunch of cool ideas, like from you, Craig, and Derek are just popping up and just kind of neat. And just you make it what it is.
Yeah, I mean, also, obviously, if you're not running it exactly as printed, it means more work for you as the DM. And if you're an experienced DM and you're comfortable putting in the extra effort, great. And I mean, I think your table's going to appreciate the work you've done. They won't even realize you've made change because, I mean, they don't know what it's supposed to do.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if you were a new DM, you've never run it before, like, I could see how this would be a huge problem. But,
I think it might also be interesting if, you know, if any of your players are aware of the story and that Bertram is, like, really under the control of the reptile god, or he's involved in it somehow, to sort of play with that and have him actually not be involved with it, right? Like, even if you did go into that basement and he just comes down, he does just want to talk to them about, like, listen, lots of crazy stuff's been happening. These guys have been using my place for a long time. I was under the spell, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, having some sort of alternate situation.
Or have Bertram be one of the good guys who is really one of the spies and was trying to weed out one of the other guys in the bar to see who was the cultist leader.
Yeah, I mean, you haven't set the precedent yet for it, right?
Bertram could be a good guy for all we know.
Yeah, as long as none of the townsfolk have already tipped their hat or used his name, then go with whatever's going to work. Yeah. You got a week to figure it out.
two days, actually.
We're running these on Wednesday nights.
It's Wednesday nights.
Yes.
Friday's our catch-up session from last week.
Yes, of course.
Indeed.
So next week is not the finale, but next week is sort of the end of the non-linear parts of it. So I suspect most groups, obviously Mark being like the exception, are either going to face the reptile god, which we talked about already this week, the lower level of the moat house, which we've talked about this week, or the Caves of Chaos, which we've already talked about a little bit, but anyone who is playing the adventure on the straightest path, that's what their last encounter is. Is that correct, guys?
Yep.
Caves of Chaos is the last one.
It is.
Yeah, because they encounter the ghost of Hommel, and he sort of fills in all the details of what's been going on, right? So for DMs that are going to be running that one next week, what, if any, advice can you think of? Maybe something even that we've already suggested a few weeks back, but just so that it's top of mind. Craig, can you think of anything? Like, what would you recommend to DMs running that next week for the first time?
Sorry, for which one? Was it the...
Caves of Chaos.
Caves of Chaos.
Oh, well, I haven't run it yet, so...
Oh, well. But you've played it already, though, have you not?
No, I haven't even played it. I'll be doing both those next week.
Oh, nice. Well.
At both tables.
Fresh on both ends.
Indeed.
Mark, what about you? I know you ran it, and you had some challenges when you ran it, right? So after we've talked about it a little bit, have you had any other thoughts on it? Like, what recommendations would you suggest for DMs running that one next week?
Well, I like your idea of actually bringing the minions out from both ends. Assailing them from both ends, so from the tunnel as well as from the wilderness. I also recommend to DMs maybe possibly use a different map. Open it up a little bit, because if you've got a party of 5, 6, your ogre is going to be so underpowered because he's just in the hallway tunnel by himself, unless you can get him out in the open. That's the other thing, but ogres are not necessarily known for their intelligence, right? Use a little more open area, and you'll find that your party will have a little more difficulty against this. That's one of the big things. Play up half-run Hommel. Play him up a lot. Make him a big, big, interesting part in it, too. I think that's always a good thing if you want to do a little bit of role-playing. Half-run Hommel has a couple of cool powers, so you can throw in a few extra minions that half-run takes on. That would just add a little bit of flavor to the encounter.
I know when I ran it, I used the ghost of Hafren Hommel as sort of the get out of jail free card. When the party was making their last ditch effort to flee, and there wasn't any good in-game story reason that they should be able to outrun the monsters, that's when I introduced the ghost to sort of say, okay, you guys killed a whole bunch of the minions, you saved Otis, you've got the sword, you're all wounded very badly, and now you're running as fast as you can to get out of there. At that point, it just seemed like a cheat to keep throwing more minions at them. So I basically had the ghost act as a roadblock.
Right, like he's like the Gandalf for the party.
Yeah, like he showed up at the exact moment when they absolutely needed the most help. But I had no intention of having him show up to help them fight. Like if they were in over their head and it was a TPK thing, you know, I would have figured out how to do it. But I wasn't going to have him show up and say, oh, well, you know, I'm going to throw a heel to this guy and I'm going to, like, no. I mean, you made your bed, you're going to live with it, but...
Oh, no, I mean, like, just have him as an integral part, like, saying, okay, I need you guys to go over there, get out of here now, I'll hold off these, and then all of a sudden you send in, like, 10 minions when you know the party's leaving, right? Like, just make him an integral part of the combat, which is kind of neat.
Yeah, I like that idea of having him almost like to be the leader, not leader in the sense of warlord, cleric, like leader class, but leader in the sense of combat commander, like calling out, I see more guys coming, get out of there. And I know when I ran it as the DM, I had him, you know, leave no doubt in their mind that they were not going to be able to kill all the monsters, that their objective was to find the sword and get out. And I drilled it into them like 3 or 4 times before I proceeded on to the next part, so that if they did suffer a TPK, they weren't going to look at me as the DM after and go, well, that wasn't fair, you kept throwing monsters at us. I wanted it to be very clear that they were going to encounter more monsters than they could handle. I think that's sort of a fair way to do it.
I think that was the idea of the encounter also.
Yeah, no, and I got to admit, I really, really liked that encounter. Like you said, Mark, I made a few small changes to it in that I had some of the monsters come from the cave entrance and some sneak around from the outside. One of the things that helped was that some of the party stayed outside so they could sort of potentially see some of those threats coming and draw fire, basically fight on two fronts instead of have everyone bottlenecked at one point.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you're a DM running that encounter next week and your party doesn't have a controller, like, oh boy, be in for some trouble. It's going to be a tough, tough encounter, and tactics will make all the difference.
Hint, hint, Craig, DM player.
Yeah, seriously. Now, let me ask you a question, though. Is that ogre, is it can he just come from the outside as opposed to starting from the inside, or is that going to
I have come from the outside and blocked.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because that's what I was... Well, I shouldn't say anything since you'll be a player next week. Yeah. Because that's... But based on our conversations, I had already sort of, like, pictured different things that I was going to do for this encounter, and that was... certainly one of the things I was mulling over.
I just found that the tunnel part, though, I mean, you kind of, you know, you have this whole interaction with Hafron, right? And he's going, oh, well, this party went in there weeks ago, and I can't go in there, and there's a whole bunch of monsters and everything like that. The party walks in, four squares, they're basically at the Chaos Blade. Like, I don't like the size of the tunnel itself. And that's the part that bothers me most about this encounter.
But that it's just, like, right there?
It's right there.
Yeah.
And
I didn't have it right there. I had it, like, around the corner in that little pocket. Right in to get it.
Yes, but still, I kind of pictured, like, when Hafron was talking, I had in my head, right, when I was playing, I'm like, oh, well, this intricate network of tunnels, like, you could have had a little more of a maze. I guess there's only limited size for the map that they can do, but I probably just would open up that area and just make it a little more, you know, have minions come from secret doors, just kind of like they did in that drow, the drow in the web of the Spider Queen, you know, come in this and that. But it's just little things like how you could change it based on what you think your players will react to. I mean, you did it one way, I did another way, and you know, they both turned out equally good.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, and I think too, I mean, like I said, I haven't run it yet, but I know he, like, if you were to do the Chaos Caves earlier, then you can get some more story elements put out a little earlier. So, but I mean, doing it at this late in the game, you can start to tie things together a lot more, right? So, like, your guys are going to show up with two of the three items and they're about to get the third, right? So it doesn't need to be so mysterious, I guess, as it might be written. Like, you can start pointing it towards the end sign kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it actually does look like an arrow when I'm looking at the map here.
Yeah.
Pointing to the end.
Indeed.
One other thing I'm just thinking of with as far as the waves of monsters in the Caves of Chaos is some of the monsters are traditionally subterranean. Like, I think there's kobolds and goblins, like creatures that normally don't go out in the sunlight.
Yeah.
So when I had those creatures come, I had them come exclusively from the inside. But when it was like, I think hobgoblins and
orcs.
Yeah. I had them split up. I had like three outside and two inside because I figure those creatures can function just fine outside without any penalty. And with the other ones, I think I might've had one or two come from the outside, but I intentionally gave them penalties to their attack roll to sort of compensate for that sunlight blindness. Like, I think in one of the old systems, they actually had like daylight sensitivity was a thing. So again, it was just something that was a little bit of a story for me. I don't think the players really realized that I was doing it, especially the new players who don't really have that D&D background. But I know for me that was sort of my internal justification for why should some monsters come from outside and some from inside.
So. Very cool. So, Craig, now you have everything you need to run this as a DM and as a player.
Exactly.
No metagaming.
Oh. Let's tell the players at my table to sit back. I got it.
Watch out. There's monsters coming this way.
Well, we don't have, I'm trying to think. Do we even? I don't even think we have a controller in that party on the Harry T store.
No. Yeah, we don't. We do not.
Unless our witch shows up. I think she's got beguiling strands in her bag of tricks.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
She's missed a few sessions, so hopefully she's there, but if not, twin strike for the win.
She should be. The only reason she wasn't there this week, she was getting a tattoo done that happened to go right into the game time. So she didn't.
Was it a Dungeons & Dragons tattoo like the previous ones you guys have?
It could be thought of as that. It's kind of like, it's like a Wendigo type creature.
Ooh. I like Wendigos.
We get off topic yet again.
Oh, yes. But yeah, so I guess what we're talking about, the most likely last scenarios that will be run.
Yeah.
So what the other ones, we have the Reptile God Caverns, and we also have the
Motor Dungeon.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, well, and then, so we'll run next week's. We'll see how our finales go all around. We'll compare our notes as usual, and then we'll prep up for the grand finale.
Yep, absolutely. I think one thing that, you know, I think all the DMs running it, regardless of whatever they're going to be running next week, is just to take a hard look at the information that you've sort of given out your characters over the course so far, whether it's maybe they don't know a whole lot about things going on right now, or you know, like, start filling in blanks for them now.
And yeah.
you can start making ties. Because, I mean, one of the things that I know that we've been discussing previously as well is how some of the things are kind of separate from each other, right? Like you have the cult, the reptile god cult, and you have the moat house, which are kind of separated from each other, but you can start making the ties happen there if you're playing the end of one of those scenarios where they can reference each other. They can talk about how, they fought, this is the group that foiled so-and-so's plans, now they've left it all up to us, or, you know, or whatever, so, something like that.
Yeah.
Just to make it feel like a little more cohesive, I guess.
Sounds good.
Yep, sounds good.
All right, so I guess we'll see both of you next week, and happy gaming. Oh, and for everybody out there, not only plan well, have fun. Make it fun for your players. That's it, that's all. As much as you want to, be the best DM, whatever, have fun.
Absolutely, yeah.
Excellent. So this concludes Session 6 of D&D Encounters Season 12 Against the Cult of Chaos. Join us next week when we talk about Session 7.
You can follow me on Twitter at @Amaron_DM, and be sure to visit DungeonsMaster.com for original D&D 4th Edition material, including a weekly field report of my D&D Encounters experiences.
And follow me on Twitter at 20foot and visit 20footradius.blogspot.com for your weekly dose of D&D encounters. That's 20footradius20ftradius.blogspot.com. Until then, have a blast.